Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic for tonight is misconceptions, LGBT fertility, and fighting the FDA. As more than 23,000 delegates from over 195 countries convene this week in Washington for the International AIDS Conference, LGBT rights advocates and others in California are trying to raise awareness about policies and guidelines that they say place undue and unnecessary restrictions on LGBT individuals looking to conceive. They say these policies were informed by concerns around the transmission of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, but they might be outdated and discriminatory at this point. One concern surrounds the costly and time-consuming procedures that lesbian couples and others must go through when they are trying to conceive in a medical setting through the use of a known sperm donor. A second concern relates to what LGBT rights advocates say are discriminatory FDA guidelines that ban gay men from being sperm donors, unless they have been completely celibate for the preceding 5 years. Tonight, we bring together voices who are trying to remove these barriers to family making for the LGBT community. With legal, personal, medical, and historical perspectives and more, in our studio, we welcome Kate Kendall, the Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Actually, welcome back, Kate.
Thanks, Joseph.
We also have Leland Trayman, a family nurse practitioner who owns and operates Rainbow Flag Health Services and Sperm Bank, a fertility service with a special interest in the LGBT community, and those services are located in Alameda. Welcome, Leland.
Hello.
And we're also joined by Dr. Juno Obadin-Maliver. She's a resident physician with the UCSF Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. Her research and clinical interests include maternal mortality, family planning, LGBTQ health, and medical education. Welcome, Dr. Juno.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
And a little bit later, we'll be joined by Maya Scott-Chung. She's a public health consultant and advocate, health educator, and grassroots organizer, and she'll be speaking as a queer parent. And we'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes to your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or go to the KALW website and search for us under programs, and you can post a comment there. So, Leland Trayman, I wanted to start with you. Why don't you sketch out for us the concerns you have, and by telling us a little bit about the procedures that lesbian couples and others have to go through versus different sex couples or opposite gender couples have to go through when they are seeking fertility services within a medical setting.
Well, there are many problems, but what we're focusing on now is specifically fresh insemination with a directed donor. If a heterosexual couple wants to conceive a child and they fail to conceive it in the privacy of their own bedroom, they go to a medical facility, and the first thing they do is they suggest doing what is called an intrauterine insemination. It's not a high-tech procedure. It's a very low-tech procedure. They take the man's sperm, they wash it, they concentrate down the sperm cells. They do what is essentially a pelvic exam on the woman, and they insert the sperm directly into her uterus. And this increases one's chances of pregnancy. Well, if one is a lesbian couple, for example, and they've been inseminating at home with a good friend or
Who's donating the sperm.
From a public health perspective, the woman who is being inseminated is being exposed to his bodily fluids in the same way a heterosexual woman is being exposed to her partner. So from a public health perspective, you'd think that if she doesn't get pregnant and then she goes to her doctor, they treat her the same way. But they don't. They say, oh, my God, he is not, quote, your sexually intimate partner, end quote. They say he is just, quote, a donor, end quote. And because he is just a donor, he must do one of two things. He must freeze his sperm, have it quarantined for 6 months. He must be then retested, and then you can use his sperm then. Well, the problem with that is if the woman is 38, 39, 40, 41, 42. She doesn't have 6 months to wait. Female fertility, unfortunately, decreases dramatically from month to month, particularly after the age of 40. The other thing is that only a minority of men, and this is something most people don't know, only a minority of men have sperm that survives the freezing process well enough so that it can be used when it's thawed out. So you're basically telling the vast majority of women who have known donors who've been inseminating at home, no, you can't do that. We're talking about 5 out of every 6 you would be saying no to. 5 out of 6. Well, again, from a public health perspective, these people are being exposed in exactly the same way. So we are here supporting Assembly Bill AB 2356 that basically broadens the concept, broadens the definition for the term sexually intimate partner to include people who've inseminated at home, but only with regards to public health and not with regards to custody issues.
Okay. We're going to get more into the AB 2356. 2356. Thank you. In just a moment. But I wanted to turn next to Dr. Juno Obedin-Maliver from UCSF. Tell us, from your understanding, what is the reasoning behind why there is this difference between what a heterosexual couple has to do or not have to do in order to have that intrauterine insemination versus what a lesbian couple, or my understanding is also a single woman, if she wanted to go ahead and do this and use a known sperm donor. Why that difference?
Well, I think it largely stems from a well-intentioned public health glitch in my mind that may be outdated at this point. So I think healthcare providers, whether those are physicians or nurse practitioners that are helping couples to create families, especially in an era of infectious disease, were concerned about exposing their patients unknowingly to an unacceptable level of risk. So in an era when HIV/AIDS and the transmission and timing between infection and confirmation of seropositivity, or between the time that an individual contracted the HIV virus and the blood test was positive, that window period was quite long initially before we had better technology than what we have now.
How long was that window?
So initially 1 year and then 6 months, and it has gotten shorter and shorter. And unfortunately, a lot of our medical practices have not kept up with that. And a lot of our legal our guidelines and legal statutes have also not kept up with that. So now we have better technology and also a better sense of who is at risk and what are risky behaviors and populations that may have a higher risk of contracting HIV, but also other infectious diseases. And so this idea that we would either make people wait or retest sperm at a periodic basis in order to ensure that as a practitioner, I was not unduly exposing my patients to an infectious disease while trying to help them conceive or create a family. So it was really, I think, well-intentioned and trying to reduce harms. But we're at a different place now.
So you're saying that there's a gap between the technology that's going to be able to detect whether someone is carrying an infectious disease that's unknown to them,
right,
and the policy that was created to protect people from being infected unknowingly.
Absolutely.
And since we went from being able to detect these window periods, as you say, to now being to be able to detect much sooner, somehow policy hasn't caught up.
Absolutely.
So, Kate Kendall, I have a question for you. Is it truly just a matter of catch-up? Is it just the fact that, the science has shown us that we can speed up the process here? Or is there something else behind why there's this difference between what a heterosexual couple has to do versus what a lesbian couple or a single mother to be, or an aspiring single mother to be?
Well, the most charitable view is, of course, that the science just hasn't caught up, and the policy hasn't caught up to the science,
yep.
And folks are just working very, very hard and haven't paid attention to where we are now. But there's more than that, obviously, because, you know, we know that homophobia is a part of what's going on. We know that AIDS phobia is a part of what's going on, and that it's been, you know, it's difficult to have rational conversations if people are ruled by fear or bias or prejudice or stereotypes. And so what we're really asking for here is that we want the best science and cooler heads and fair, rational approaches to prevail. And we want equality across the board for anyone seeking to conceive. We want women, whether they're lesbians or whether they're single women or whether they're married to men in heterosexual relationships, we want to be treated like adults. And if we're apprised of the risks, we have the ability as adults to make choices. And as we think about planning our families, the reason this legislation is so important from our perspective and long overdue, and this is something that Leland's been working on for years and years, is that it gives women now the only other option if they want to use a known donor and fresh semen is to inseminate at home with no safeguards whatsoever,
yes.
With no consultation with a doctor, with no testing of the semen at all. So in some ways, by closing our eyes to the reality of how our families are formed now and where the science is now, we've actually put women at more risk than having a common sense policy that says, look, we're going to apply the definition of sexually intimate partner to anyone who knowingly and willingly wishes to be inseminated with fresh semen, regardless of their sexual orientation or their marital status. We would prefer that you do that with the doctor's care, like you go to Dr. Juno and she can advise you of what potential risk there might be. She can do the proper testing. There's no reason to not now approach this with a common sense, very matter-of-fact, reality-based assessment.
Are you saying, though, that people shouldn't be trying at home, so to speak? Don't do this at home. Should people not be trying at home? Let's say a lesbian couple gets a sperm donor who happens to be known to them, well, is known to them, whether it's a friend or somebody else. You're saying that the system now, people could be potentially, which doesn't regulate what happens in the bedroom, right, mm-hmm, or wherever mm-hmm. else this is happening right. in the home, doesn't regulate that you, we're actually saying we're putting in this regulation at sort of the second step when there is already a first step where no one's being advised as what the risks are. So what are you saying about what happens at that first step?
Well, I would never make that categorical direction. I would never say no women should ever inseminate at home with fresh semen. It depends on the relationship you have. It depends on the conversations you've had. I mean, there are men that I have in my life that I would absolutely, if I were not well past childbearing age and were interested in having a child, if I wanted to use one of them as a known donor, I would be perfectly comfortable using fresh semen from them because I have a trust relationship where I'm not concerned that their behavior would have exposed them or created risk. So I think it's very individualized. But certainly from a public policy standpoint, when we're making public policy is categorical rules. If we're making a categorical rule, and right now there's this categorical ban, which makes no sense, at least have a categorical rule that reflects the best science and the reality of how people are forming families.
So that once people actually enter into a medical care around this issue, you're saying let's have the science and the policy kind of match up
exactly.
better.
Exactly.
Anything you wanted to add there, Juno, before I actually have Leland outline the tenets of AB 2356?
Well, I think one thing to add that goes off of what Kate was saying was that medicine is also, although not as strictly rule-based, but we go by guidelines. And that's something that needs to shift in addition to the law is and to reflect, I think, what is becoming more current medical practice to recognize the relationship between physicians and their patients in a partnership. And what this recognizes is that working with adult patients who are fully abreast of their risks is something that we can negotiate in a partnership, and we can really take adults through this process knowingly and let them make decisions that are right for them. And that's also a new shift, I think, in medicine. And we also, as practitioners, need to catch up with that.
And I think I'm going to save this question, but I'll put it out there now so you'd be thinking about the answer. How do we still make sure we're safeguarding the people who may not be as well-informed or health-literate in this situation if we're starting to remove some of those barriers that you say are not necessary in the first place, but perhaps there's some unintended situations that we can't predict? So I'm going to put that out there for now. But Leland Trayman, back to you. This has been, as others have already said, the focus of some of your attention for quite some time. Tell us how you got to this point of wanting to write some legislation, how long it's taken, and then walk us through the actual legislation.
Okay. How long it's taken? About 15 years. I want to be very clear. The FDA regulations, which do have the force of law, do not ban fresh insemination with directed donors. They do not. They don't like that idea, and they have made it rather burdensome to do it by adding an incredible layer of testing, way beyond reason.
Given the current science.
Yes, but it's but it is not banned. But specifically, the wording of AB 2356 came up for me because a couple of years ago I was asked by a member of the staff of an assembly member of the California legislature to help with a bill so that primarily heterosexual men or men in heterosexual relationships who were HIV positive and were in relationship with an HIV negative woman could that they would change the law so that these men could get fertility assistance and that the fertility, high-tech fertility doctors could assist them in actually having a child. And
by sperm washing or some other method.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm. And the original legislation was introduced a number of years ago by Carol Migden, but the wording of that was somewhat ambiguous. So Assemblyman Jerry Hill, a very good friend of the LGBT community and the HIV-positive community, wanted to clear that up so that doctors felt more comfortable doing this procedure. So with particularly with the help of Dr. Deborah Cohen at UCSF, who's just a wonderful, wonderful woman, he wrote this legislation. The original draft of it was passed by the legislature, vetoed by then-Governor Schwarzenegger. And I actually was glad he did because it still didn't do the job. It still didn't clear things up. And when I was approached to help, I don't know how many hours I spent banging out word for word exactly what we needed. And we passed, we did it, and it passed the legislature again. And at that point, Schwarzenegger signed it. And then I thought to myself, my God, if we can make it easier for HIV-positive heterosexual men to be sperm donors and to have fertility services, certainly we should be able to make it easier for lesbians who want to use HIV-negative men to be their sperm donors. Because at that point in history, it was easier in the state of California if you were heterosexual and HIV-positive in a relationship to get fertility care than if you were a lesbian couple and had a known donor who was negative. I mean, that's insane.
And this is because?
This is because that despite the fact that the HIV regulations didn't ban gay men or, but they have a guidance document that does ban gay men as being sperm donors. And in their regulations, they also made it incredibly burdensome to do fresh insemination with directed donors. And my perspective was that if you've been inseminating at home, it's your business whether the guy ejaculates into a cup and then you go into a separate room and inseminate, or if you actually had intercourse with him. It's not my business. My business is public health. My business is helping you get pregnant. So I said, from a public health standpoint, these two people, these two different situations, should be treated equally.
But according to the law, they're not seen as the same.
No, that is technically not true. According to the law, they are. But because of the guidance document, because of the term sexually intimate partner and how most people interpret it, they are treated differently. My perspective on AB 2356 is that it really doesn't change the law. It simply clarifies it so that physicians feel more comfortable doing what the science says is safe and defines terminology more clearly. Now, some people will say that's a change in the law, and if they want to insist that, that's fine. I don't believe that's the case. I think it is simply a clarification of what is already allowed, because I've been doing it for clients. The FDA has come and inspected me. They've sort of growled at me and said, and then they said, well, yeah, you're right. And since I was right...
Because you said earlier that the FDA regulations have the force of law, so...
The FDA... No.
Were you breaking the law?
No. There are two things that the FDA does, is puts out regulations, which has the force of law, and then they put out a guidance document, which is an opinion piece, which is what they would like to see happen, but does not have the force of law. Nonetheless, many people in the medical community follow guidance documents as if it were regulation, despite the fact that on the top of every page of every guidance document, it says, and I quote, contains non-binding recommendations.
Let me hold you there for a moment. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the LGBT community and their fight to expand access to fertility treatments within the medical community. With our guests here, Leland Trayman, a family nurse practitioner who owns and operates Rainbow Flag Health Services and Sperm Bank in Alameda, Kate Kendall, executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Dr. Juno Obadon-Maliver, resident physician with the UCSF Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. 415-841-4134 is the number to join, to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or go to the KALW website at klw.org and search for us under programs and post a comment there. 415-841-4134. Okay, back to you, Leland.
Yes.
So you are at this point where you recognize that the guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They're not law. Mm-hmm. And you felt comfortable that the science was sufficient enough to be able to say that it's safe to do intrauterine insemination of a lesbian woman with a known sperm donor without having to go through the extra hurdles of freezing the sperm and retesting it and testing it to make sure that there were no infectious diseases lurking inside. The FDA came by and inspected you and said, we don't like it, but it's actually okay.
Yes.
And then you said, well, it's time for AB 2356.
Right. Well, a little history on that. The FDA wanted to and put out publicly before their regulations were finalized in 2004 that they were going to ban fresh insemination with directed donors. And needless to say, I didn't like that. And I recruited Kate, who flew back with me to Maryland to talk to the FDA, who are not, they're not very nice people. But Kate is one of the heroes that she said, no, we're not going to let them do this. And I will also say the ACLU has also been very, very helpful. So all of you there, be sure that you renew your ACLU membership. And I have to disclose that I sit on the board of the Paul Robeson chapter of the ACLU. With the help of the ACLU and NCLR, we convinced the FDA not to put it in their regulations. But it was almost, it's been, well, we've won the war, but we've lost the, we're losing the battles. Because they said, okay, we won't put it in the regulations. Ha, ha, ha. We'll put it in the guidance document. Nah, nah. most people follow that anyway. And that's where the discrimination has come from, despite the fact that from a legal point of view, guidance documents have no more force, really, if you're going to stand up against them, than toilet paper. But most doctors are too afraid to do that. Most doctors are too, they're terrified of the FDA. I'm just a little faggot. I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm not even a doctor. And I stand up to the FDA. But these doctors who have multi-million dollar practices, who have much more power than I do, are terrified of losing their status in the community, their income, whatever.
So let's get to the nuts and bolts in like a few sentences of what you're trying to achieve with AB 2356.
As I said, well, when I first approached Kate about it, I said, let's just redefine the term sexually intimate partner to include people who've already been doing vaginal inseminations at home with their donors. There have been other amendments, you know, two things you never want to see being made are sausage and legislation. And so it's our two sentences are now, what, four or five paragraphs, but they essentially say the same thing. And since it's been expanded to make the doctors even more comfortable than our original intent, AB 2356 has now been supported by the California Medical Association and by Kaiser Permanente. Wow.
Hmm. So, Kate, a couple of questions. First, why did you get on that plane with Leland and go back to Maryland? That's first. Second, why are we here talking about this? It sounds like you're moving in the right direction. You got the assembly on board. Like, what more do we need to be hearing about regarding this legislation?
Well, as to the first question, Leland's never asked you to do anything, I take it.
No, I have not met him before tonight.
because when Leland asks you to do something, you do it. And we, you know, with regard to this issue, I mean, obviously, you know, at the National Center for Lesbian Rights, I mean, one of the key program areas in which we work is family law. And we want lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals to be able to form families however they wish, with the law and policy supporting and reflecting the reality of their family. So this was very consistent with what we wanted and what we see our job to be. And what we were very worried, rightly so, that the FDA was going to outright ban in regulation HIV positive men from being sperm donors and gay men from being sperm donors. And
gay men, whether they're HIV positive
gay
or
men,
not?
Whether they're HIV positive or not.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's right. So that's important clarification. Gay men, whether they're HIV positive or not. And we knew that that would be disastrous for, you know, obviously for the gay male community, but also for the lesbian community and for any woman, regardless of sexual orientation, who wants to use a gay man as her donor. And so we did. We had a productive meeting with the FDA where we stopped them from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get everything we wanted, as Leland pointed out. And it has been a many years long struggle because that trip back to D.C. was under the Clinton administration. So it has been a very, very long time. Right. And the reason we're still here now is that, you know, we're lucky to live in a state where many of the big battles for just a place where one feels a sense of opportunity and dignity and self-actualization have been realized in California for LGBT people. We have employment protections in many places in this state. You can be openly LGBT and be protected. I mean, obviously, that's not true of the entire state, but there are relationship recognition protections. There are lots of parenting protections. We've accomplished a lot in this state, but we really have to always be thinking about who's being left behind. And when we look at that question and we see where the law is with regard to lesbians wishing to have children, particularly for lesbians who are poor, who do not have access to thousands of dollars that they can spend on fertility treatments. They need to have intrauterine insemination with fresh semen, especially if they're of a certain age, because also quarantining semen is expensive. It can be several thousand dollars to quarantine that and wait for several months or for 6 months. So, you know, we're talking about some of the folks in our community who do not have access to the wealth necessary to be able to afford these services. And, you know, we're really about making sure that as we see progress made, we don't leave anybody behind, and that everyone can be on a level playing field consistent with good science and good policy.
This is 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org, and it's City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the LGBT community's access or attempts to gain greater access to fertility treatments in the medical community and some Californians who are working on that very effort. And they are Kate Kendall, the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Leland Trayman, family nurse practitioner in Alameda, and Dr. Juno Obedin-Maliver, resident physician with the UCSF Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Are you a lesbian couple that's considering doing intrauterine insemination or has had experience with this and will have some questions or comments or perspective or experience to share? 415-841-4134. Or are you someone who thinks that these kinds of regulations should not be loosened? 415-841-4134. Feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. So, Juno, I want to go to you. Can you, for a moment, try to get into the head of the FDA?
I don't know if I want to go there, okay. Actually.
It's very unpleasant, yes.
A little prickly in there.
And explain to us what you think, from their perspective, is the reason why, even though they succumb to Kate and Leland's plea to not ban gay men, hetero, HIV positive or not, from being fresh sperm donors. They kept it from being a regulation, which would have been law of the land, to making it a guideline. What was it that, what are they holding on to in terms of science? What's their scientific argument, if any? And what are some other pieces of this that can kind of give us some a sense of why it's this movement is not where you want it to be, so to speak?
So I am no expert in the FDA, and I think any body like the FDA is going to be heterogeneous. There's going to be a lot of different people, a lot of different forces at play. But what I come back to is, don't think that at this point the science is on their side, in the sense that what we're asking for is that lesbian and single women are basically supported in doing what they are practically unable to do, but heterosexual couples are able to do in their bedrooms.
But are they pointing to any science in upholding these guidelines?
Not that. So I think it comes back to this infectious disease risk is what it often comes back to, and the concern that a known donor may have an infectious disease that is not picked up. And the concern by physicians, which is a real one, that we would do something that would put our patients at harm. But I think there's another piece to this, which is maybe going out on a limb, but I think the FDA and other physicians are people, and we've been raised in this society, and there is a lot of homophobia. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a study among California physicians, and 18% of them said that they were uncomfortable taking care of LGBT or Q people.
In general.
This was a general physician, general survey of California physicians of all specialties.
So not related to the fertility
no,
treatment that we're
talking
about. No, but just
generally
here.
Speaking. So I think this is applicable in that if you have physicians who are uncomfortable, then, you know, that at every turn in supporting their patients, so asking about what a lesbian woman's goals are for childbearing, helping her to diagnose maybe an infertility that hasn't yet been diagnosed because she's not exposed to sperm, and then affording her the full range of reproductive options starting at an early age is something that I think doctors don't pay enough attention to, and It's a particular area of research of mine, and that we know that medical students aren't taught how to take care of LGBT patients. And so it starts very early.
So actually, perfect timing for that comment, because we have an email from Jessica in Oakland who says, what about the experience of queer patients with their often AIDS-phobic and homophobic doctors? What is the image of reeducating doctors about queer fertility needs?
Well, yeah, well, I think education is where we're at. I think there's a lot of unlearning that needs to happen. In most medical textbooks that med students are given, LGBT communities, and it's actually usually just homosexual men that are mentioned, are almost always mentioned in the context of HIV. And the very positive other experiences and just other health needs and health resources that lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender individuals have are not addressed at all. So things like differential cancer risks between lesbians and heterosexual women, different rates of smoking, different rates of obesity, exercise, there's a lot of differences. And all of those things, including fertility and how to talk to patients about those, are just not addressed. And it's like a black hole and a real blind spot for a lot of physicians.
Well, you know, as we think about what we need to tackle, I mean, clearly the homophobia and the AIDS phobia is a big piece of it. But, you know, there's clearly a fair amount of misogyny here, too,
yes.
In terms of yes. Women can't make decisions for themselves. You know, this is a very paternalistic, you know, if you sort of step back, it's a very paternalistic approach to say, we don't think you can make these decisions for yourself to use fresh semen, so we're just going to say you can't or you shouldn't. You know, I think we have to, as we think about re-education and as we think about how people are socialized, you know, those are going to be key pieces as well that we're going to need to tackle.
Mm-hmm. And Leland, I know you've been jumping to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, in terms of dealing with the FDA, now in 2012, we now have not only the standard antibody test, which has gotten better and better and better and better and more accurate, we also have what is called the NAT test, which is actually better than the standard antibody test. It tests actually for the virus itself. And whenever there is a quote-unquote tissue donor of any sort, a sperm donor being a tissue donor, everyone's tested with now both of those tests. We're doing double testing. But 12 years ago, I attended a conference on tissue transplantation sponsored by the CDC, and I spoke with the head of the Department of Blood at the FDA, who's still there, Dr. Jay Epstein, and he said gay men should be excluded from being sperm donors because there was one case of a man who had been a plasma donor who tested negative repeatedly on the then standard antibody test. And he said to me, if there's one man out there, there must be others. If there's others, then they're probably in the high-risk group. Gay men are in the high-risk group, and therefore we should exclude gay men. And I said to him, Dr. Epstein, I think if you go before a judge, and because if you do this, we will take you to court. If you go before a judge and you say gay men should be excluded from the donor pool because of one heterosexual man in Utah who was infected with HIV from his wife, and that is your rationale for excluding gay men in the donor pool, I don't think the judge is going to look very kindly on that.
I have a question. Is there any other regulation from the FDA that says gay men cannot donate anything else? For example, organs?
Blood, organs, other things? Absolutely.
So
yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
They are not allowed to.
Right.
Okay. But it's not just sperm.
No.
We're talking about
it. No. There's a categorical ban on donation of.
But there's nothing in the regulation that says that it's a known gay male donor that cannot donate for fresh insemination. Correct.
Yes.
Right.
It's a known donor, but the undertext is that it's gay men. Correct. Because I'm thinking of people who are doing organ transplants, right?
Right.
What? There's no 6-month waiting period in organ transplantation, correct?
Right.
So is that really? I mean, I just want to drive that point home. If that indeed is the point, that there's nothing that explicitly says gay men, but it's sort of insinuated that way, or the practice of lesbians reach out mostly to gay men, and therefore that's the issue. Can you disentangle that for me?
Well, it's correct me if I'm wrong, and Dr. Juno probably knows this answer for sure, so I shouldn't even be jumping in here. But it's men who have sex with men within the last 5 years mm-hmm. cannot donate blood or semen. Probably they can't donate organs too if that is known about them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's such an emergent situation that I'm not sure, you know, if this is you're first on the liver list and you've got 2 weeks to live, you know, this may be, you know, you'll take the liver.
Right.
So that's less likely to come up. But there is a categorical ban on donation of blood and this categorical ban on donating semen. And the exception that we want from that when we're talking about fresh sperm is this directed donor, somebody you know
yes.
that you are assuming the risk and that this is the person you want to be inseminated with his fresh semen.
But are you asking that person's semen not to be tested at all?
Oh, no.
Yeah, no.
Everyone gets tested. I mean,
if they go to a doctor, and this is what the concern
is. So
we
you're
have.
Trying to eliminate the 6-month waiting period and the retesting.
And I want to correct slightly what
please,
Kate said. Blood donors, if you've had sex with a man even once since 1977, you cannot be a blood donor in the United States.
Well, then my standard was generous.
Yes,
it was right. Only 5 years.
The tissue donation, which semen falls under, is again not part of regulation, but is a part of the guidance document, which most people follow as if it were regulation.
Well, it's telling that the International AIDS Conference was not allowed mm-hmm. in this country for many decades because of the ban on allowing someone who's known HIV positive to immigrate into this country. So interesting to see as this shift has taken place on that level of policy that this question is now coming. Although it's obviously the sense is that the stakes are a lot higher. As I imagine that's the FDA's point of view here. So I want to bring in at this point Maya Scott Chung. She's a public health consultant and advocate and health educator and grassroots organizer. But she's here tonight to talk about her personal experience related to what we're talking about here. So, Maya, can you encapsulate for us what your experience has been and why the changes that Leland and Kate and Juno are advocating for are important to you and how they would have changed your experience?
Sure. Well, I'm a lesbian mom of an almost 8-year-old daughter, Luna. I'm Scottish-Irish. My partner, Chino, who is transgender and butch, is Mexican and Chinese. And when we wanted to have a child, we wanted to have a biological child, if possible. We were also totally open to adoption. And initially, when we began to think about whether we wanted to use sperm from a sperm bank or from a known donor, we weren't really sure, actually. So we began to look in sperm banks all around the country. We found one Mexican Chinese sperm donor in the entire country. And within 3 or 4 weeks of talking with our friends, we knew 4 people who were using that exact sperm donor.
Whoa.
This was a little over 10 years ago when we were first starting to think about having a child. And at the time, having donor siblings, which is actually becoming more common, was something that was a little intimidating for us. And just thinking that, wow, we might have, you know, 5 or 6 siblings just within our city or something, was something that was a little bit difficult for us to think of. I think we might be more open to it now. But I think that that's one thing to look at in terms of health disparities and issues coming up. That is, for families of color and for multiracial families, there are very few people mm-hmm. of color in the sperm banks to
yes.
begin with. And if you're looking at mixed heritage and multiracial people, very much less donors available. So we started to think, if we could have what we really, really wanted, dear universe, what would we want to have? And we went to a class with Maya Midwifery, which was a lesbian-run program that trained single women and queer women to be able to learn how to do home insemination and to think about our reproductive choices. And we thought, you know, if we could really have what we wanted, ideally, we really value extended family. We would love to have a donor who was kind of like an uncle figure who didn't want to be a parent but would be involved in the child's life. We would love to have more grandparents. I mean, the more grandparents, the merrier. Ideally, we would love to have an Asian and Latino guy who was a gay man or gay friendly, if he was gay or not, that the extended family and grandparents were also gay friendly, because we were concerned about the possibility of someone in that family trying to take away parentage rights from us. And when we went, really looked at that, we put out a letter to our community and we said, we're ready to be a family. We want to have a child. Does anybody know anyone who is all of these wonderful things that we're thinking of? And it seemed pretty unlikely, actually. But somebody that we know, we had lots of friends thinking of men that they knew. And somebody that we knew three Asian, Latino, gay guys in the Bay Area who might possibly be interested in being donors. And when she went through that list, one of them was Daniel, who became our donor. There were lots of reasons why we wanted to have a known donor. And again, as I said, the ethnicity was a part of it. The cost was a huge part of it. We're a working class family, and we couldn't even afford to do intrauterine insemination at that point, to even spend a couple $1,000s. We really didn't have a lot of money. So frankly, a known donor is free. We did do all of the testing that he would have done at a sperm bank, so we were very, very aware of the potential risks. And, you know, frankly, we know lots of people who have had children at home who are heterosexual, and they took exactly the same risks we did. And so, you know, I think of home insemination as sort of the queer old-fashioned way. And we were really lucky. We had a really easy time of it. I was 37. I conceived our daughter Luna on the third try. We know many people that were not so lucky.
And third try at home?
Yes, third try at home. So we did it with an artichoke jar and a syringe, and with our donor bringing his sperm over from his house. And we were not uninformed. I was in the midst of public health school. I was being trained to be a public health educator. I'm a public health activist and really, really looked at the risks and benefits of this. I think it's also really important to recognize my partner is butch and transgender identified, and both of us have had many negative experiences in the health field, in the health profession, when we go in as patients. She has had people question what gender she is, have asked her very invasive questions, and I've had countless times of going to OBGYNs through my life where, as they go through the questions, they say, so are you using birth control? And I say, no, I'm not using birth control. I'm a lesbian, you know, and just having to explain kind of the basics of things. So frankly, I wasn't highly inclined to go to the doctor if I didn't need to, as I think most heterosexual people, when they want to have children, try to have sex at home. And if that works, great. And if it doesn't, they move on. But it was also a very important thing for us to have my partner have agency and involvement and actually get me pregnant. You know, it is often a real loss and a real risk for heterosexual men who can't get their partners or their wives pregnant to have to release that ability to be involved in the conception process when they go on to going to a clinic. That was true for us as well. We really wanted my partner to be able to knock me up, and she was able to, and that was great. It was really important, actually, to us. And that's not true for everyone, but I think it's important to see that for working class people, for people of color, for mixed heritage people, for gender nonconforming people, that all the different intersectional ways that we may be marginalized from the medical system make us a cohort of people that are more likely to perhaps consider home insemination. So anyway, we were very lucky the first time.
Great. So, Dr. Juno, back to you. The question I posed but probably half an hour ago, which is, what is... So Maya talks about how she educated herself, and she was in public health school, so she was able to be able to read up on this and know what she and her partner were getting into. Tell us about how this legislation then creates any need for making sure that people are safeguarded if this this ban is relaxed, so to speak, right? What is involved in making sure people know exactly what they're getting into and the consent process for doing this?
Yeah. So there's the law doesn't change the consent process in the sense that whether a heterosexual couple or a lesbian couple or a single woman comes with a known donor, the idea of consent is always there. And actually, a big part of any embarking upon infertility service is a lot of education, whether that's education just about how does pregnancy happen, how does sperm and egg come together, and what are the barriers to that, and trying to understand that. So a lot of what we do is education at the best of times. A lot of what doctors do is education. I think that your question about safeguarding those who are either new to medicine and health or not as informed or may have less health literacy is important. But I think that that's not different than what happens with heterosexual couples. And I just keep coming back to that, you know, there is going to be a broad spectrum of lesbians who will be using this, single women. And we also haven't talked about this, but, you know, trans men who want to carry a pregnancy and have the reproductive organs to do so may identify as men, but can be pregnant. So there's a lot of people that this applies to. Intrauterine insemination with fresh sperm is often the next step, the most logical, affordable, feasible, and medically appropriate step for people in the pathway of an infertility, both workup and treatment. And so when we're educating people, it's talking about what is the risk of you acquiring a disease. And that's a conversation that happens with a couple that's been together too. They both get tested together, and there are uncomfortable situations when people believe themselves to be a heterosexual couple, believes themselves to be in a what they think is a mutually monogamous relationship, and one of them on our screening panel comes up with a sexually transmitted infection. And that is unfortunately not uncommon. Mm-hmm. That will happen as well in these situations. And there are guidelines already in place in that. Those guidelines don't need to change. It's just our conception of who to include in that counseling.
You know, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, this is about health, equal health care access. So that women who are using, who are involved in a sexual relationship with a man, they get treated one way. Right now, lesbians, bisexual women, single women who choose a donor but are not sexually intimate with him, they get treated another way. This is about saying we want those women treated the same way, because there's a fallacy in the way the policy currently operates. It operates assuming that the woman who's sexually intimate with her male partner is safer than the woman who wants a known donor but doesn't wish to be sexually intimate with him. Or, and that may not be true. Who knows where he is on the weekends?
I could see that. But I also would imagine that once you bring it into the medical practice, then are you sharing that risk with the medical provider?
And that's this is the point of the bill. There's no more risk to the medical provider. What we're saying is we want the male donor chosen by the lesbian, bisexual, the single woman to be screened in the same way that you would screen the sexually intimate partner of a woman who's coming in for fertility services. We want them both treated the same. He is what we would traditionally think of as a sexually intimate partner, the boyfriend or the husband. But there's no real clear definition of what that is. So we simply want that definition to include someone that you don't necessarily have intercourse with, but it's the person who you want to be the donor and the biological father of your baby. And it's really just saying that healthcare access that's the least expensive and the most safe, because their screening procedures applies to both sets of women equally.
Okay, so we have less than 5 minutes. Maya, a brief comment, because I want to hear about next steps with what I understand is being called Leland's Law, and also what's next with the FDA. But Maya, a brief comment there.
Well, that's exactly what happened to us when we tried to have a second child, is I was older. We were not successful at home. When we tried to go to our OBGYNs initially to find out what was next, we were not able to do fresh sperm intrauterine insemination. And when we went to reproductive endocrinologists into higher tech fertility clinics, again, we were had barriers to access to care. So it was expensive, it was insulting, it was exhausting, and it was ineffective. We were not able to have a child.
Okay. So, Leland, what's next with AB 2356? Where does it stand?
Well, it's passed the Assembly. It's passed two Senate committees. Supposedly, we're hoping, fingers crossed, it will pass the Senate. It'll then go back to the Assembly for concurrence because there have been some slight amendments. And then the big hurdle is the governor's office. And we want Kate to go talk to them because she's our big guns.
Any sense of where Jerry Brown stands on this?
We have not had conversations yet with the governor's office. But, you know, this is a governor that I think supports and understands how our families get formed in multiple different ways. I think we'll see the governor's signature on this bill.
Okay. And what's next with the FDA?
Well, you know, the FDA, you know, assuming a second Obama administration, I think this is an FDA that is peopled with individuals who really do want to see the science and the policy integrated. And I think, you know, Leland and I should make another trip to Maryland and to really talk with them about changing this guidance so that it doesn't hamstring medical care or health care providers who are feeling like, you know, they're trying to do the right thing. They're not as brave as Leland. But the law, we want them to loosen these strictures and to just have their policy reflect the reality of how these families get formed and also provide the best medical care to women, which they're not doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then Dr. Juno, back to you for a moment. What are some important points that you want to make in closing?
I think just that this is a medically unequivocal bill, as far as I'm concerned. And this would allow and unhamper providers, both midwives and nurse practitioners, as well as doctors, to help them to provide equal care and also to expand their notion of the types of families that are out there and the types of individuals that need and deserve all our care and services, regardless of their orientation or their income level.
And in the last minute, back to you, Kate, what's the next frontier in terms of family making for the LGBT community?
Well, you know, there's another interesting bill that we've been involved in that's on its way, was passed out of the Senate and is now in the Assembly. And it's a bill that would recognize, in certain limited cases, that it would allow a judge the discretion to recognize families with more than two legal parents. And we can think of all sorts of situations like this: heterosexual couples who they divorce and there's now a new step parent, lesbian or gay couples where there's an additional person, in some cases a donor, who wants to be recognized and the couple wants him recognized as a parent or her recognized as a legal mother. And that bill has a very good chance of success as well. And what I love about both of these bills is they're both on the road to saying all family forms matter and value, because it's more than just lip service. When the policy squares with the reality of how these families live their lives, everyone is better off.
And we'll have to leave it there. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Kate Kendall, the Executive Director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Leland Trayman, a family nurse practitioner who owns and operates Rainbow Flag Health Services at Sperm Bank in Alameda, Dr. Juno Obadon-Malaver, resident physician with the UCSF Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences, and Maya Scott-Chung, public health consultant, advocate, health educator, grassroots organizer, and queer parent. Thank you all for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to tell us what you thought about tonight's program, to sign up for alerts and download podcasts, check out our website. Go to the KALW.org website, search for us under programs. And I want to thank our engineer this evening, Debbie Kennedy. Always great to work with you. And also our producer, Lisa Denenmark. Thanks, Lisa. And our senior producer is Susie Britton. And join my co-host, Lauren Meltzer, next Monday when we talk about the fate of California's state parks, the ever-shifting fate of California's state parks. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.